Good morning. My name is David Berlin, and I'm the chair of the session. I know that maybe in your program there's a picture of a, I haven't even seen it, is there a picture of a chimpanzee where my face belongs? So I guess that makes a statement about the anonymity and identity on the internet. One of the reasons I think that the organizers of the event asked me to chair the session is because in addition to just being an observer of technology in my full-time job at CNET as an editor there, I'm also the organizer of an event called Mashup Camp. And how many people know what a mashup is? Okay, so that's... Okay. Did some people just not raise their hands because they didn't feel like raising their hands or they're working on their computer? Because it seemed like everybody did, except for a couple people. Should I just go into what a mashup is real quickly? Okay, so if you go to I was going to put some slides up and stuff, but just got way late on time this morning. I think if you asked any two people who profess to know what a mashup is, they wouldn't give you the same answer. My answer, generally speaking, is that it's when two sources of content are merged, but one of them has to be sort of a third-party source. So in other words, you could merge... At least one of them has to be a third-party source, and it could be two or more sources. So you could be taking a source of content, for example, Google Maps, and merging it with your own data, or you could be merging it with somebody else's data. Perhaps one of the most common examples that's cited of a mashup is where two third-party sources are merged. That's Google Maps and the database of all crimes that take place in the city of Chicago, which is a public database. It's developed by Adrian Holovaty, and it's... well, you'd be surprised because it shows all the classifications of the crimes. It shows balloons over Google Maps where they all took place. But you'd be surprised how many kidnappings take place in Chicago. I think that's the one thing that most people are surprised about when they visit this mashup. So you're basically merging information. So how does this what does this mean in the context of identity and this particular event and our guests here? I think if you tried to say, well, how is it that we express our identity on the internet? You could say you could draw a spectrum of things that say, okay, that's an expression of our identity. You could start with some basic metadata about yourself, like you know your name, your address, your phone number, et cetera, credit card information. You can move up the ladder and you could say, well, then there's also blogs and well, if I'm a mashup developer, here's my mashup. Everything essentially that you put onto the internet is an expression of your identity. And when you talk to some of the organizers of this event about some of the technologies they're working on, like Higgins, and the idea of federating identity, it turns out that our identity is actually spread across the internet. It's not in all one place. And sometimes when you take those things and you kind of bring them back together, or when things are spread apart, they call that federating ID. And so, you know, we're in this sort of weird place where if you take the idea that identity metadata lives across the entire internet for everybody, it's not all gathered in one place, and then you say, okay, what's going to happen when you take that data and you mash it together with other data? What happens next? It raises all sorts of exciting possibilities, like really cool ideas, and you'll hear about some of them today, but then it also raises all sorts of really crazy risks and fears and maybe even weird behaviors on the internet. You know, I think the first time... Is Jeff Marshall in the room? He's not here, is he?
No.
The first time that Jeff... Jeff is... he develops mashups, and I would say that he was kind of close on merging identity data with mapping data. He took... Jeff Marshall develops... He has a little company called Frozen Bear, and he developed a mashup. How many people know what Hot or Not is? Hot or Not. Are you in the database? No, okay. Hot or Not is this database where you... It's a matchmaking site. You go on the site, you click through pictures, and you rank people based on whether they're hot or not on a scale of 1 to 10. And you can enter yourself into this thing to find out what people think of you. And supposing you find somebody who you think you like and you might want to meet, there's actually a way to meet them. Not everybody, because they can turn off the ability to be to have introductions made. Well... What most people didn't realize is that there's a bunch of metadata available through the Hot or Not database, and Jeff Marshall merged that with with Google Maps in a way that you could say, plug in a zip code and say, show me all the single people in my area. Now, at first that sounds kind of cool and exciting, but then, you know, when I first tested it, I said, wow, I can't believe that you could actually do this. I plugged in my zip code and I saw pictures of people in my town, because I have a pretty small town, and lo and behold, like 2 days later, I was in a local farm stand up here in northern Massachusetts buying some fruit, and I saw one of the people. Now, fortunately, I'm not a stalker or anything, but that the idea of merging identity data when people who have entered that data somewhere don't know what's going to happen to it next is kind of scary, because you're not sure. You know, you think you put it in for one thing, and it suddenly starts getting used for another. And what makes it even more challenging is that just because the publisher of some metadata, for example, the Hot or Not database, says you can't have access to the data, doesn't mean you can't get to it. So we learned at the last Mashup Camp, for example, that there's something called Scrape-EI. Okay, Scrape-EI is where you actually scrape metadata off of a web page. They may not be publishing the information in a way that's accessible through a database, okay, but you can scrape the information off a web page and then treat web pages or a series of web pages as though they were a database. So this idea of your identity being scattered across the internet, or people's identities being scattered across the internet in a variety of contexts, whether it's your name, it's content you've published, which you may have copyrights to, whether it's events that you're attending. You know, if you go to EVDB, the database site, you actually get to put in, eventful.com is the face of that site. You get to put in your identity and say what events you're attending. You can actually meet up with people who are attending the same events. It's a very interesting site. Well, the events I'm attending is a part of my identity. So I think our guests all have, when you think about these different expressions for identity, have some experience that lends a lot of, you know, the way they can lend a lot of their knowledge about one specific type of expression of identity. You all work in different areas based on what I've read about you and who I've spoken to. And so what I'd first like to do is give, like, you know, everybody a few minutes to talk a little bit about, you know, their view of this, identity being mashed up. I think John likes to call it meshed up. When it involves identity, it's no longer a mashup, it's a meshup. Is that right? So you get to talk a little bit about what a meshup is. And then I'd like to dedicate at least a third, if not half, of the session to just open discussion, because these events tend to get pretty boring. People are just sitting in the front blabbing away, like I am right now, and it's not an engaged discussion, because sometimes there's people in the room who actually know more than the people up front. So if you guys are just kind of, as you go, we'll go from my left, from right here to all the way to the left, and we'll start with David, and we'll go down towards Jake, and if you guys just introduce yourselves.
Okay. I'm David Bollier, and I'm the editor of a blog called onthecommons.org. And I'm a student of the commons as a paradigm. And I'm fascinated with mashups as an interesting test question for talking about the commons, because I think mashups are both a commons and not a commons. They're not a commons because they're similar to an open access or public domain situation where there's no really community control over the resource. They're just open. And so there's no rules, no boundaries, no defined community. On the other hand, they can be a source for creating a community, as you see in a lot of music mashups, where they have their own culture, their own ethics, their own community. So I prefer to talk about the commons, just to get this paradigm straight, as a community of co-creators and users who collectively manage a resource according to their own self-created rules. And all of this, especially on the internet, allows the community to scale, and it allows the resource to be managed sustainably and to evolve and grow. I think the purest example that we can find of this is the general public license in free software, which assures that the creative output of that community is essentially controlled or not privately appropriated from that community, which is different from the public domain, where anybody can take it, appropriate it, and take it private. The Creative Commons licenses, of course, are another attempt to try to create a shared body of creative works that will have some legal standing and therefore, you know, be able to create an enforceable community, a community of practice that has enforceable norms. I think it's interesting how we're realizing that it's not just the law and the rules alone that are necessary for doing that, but often the technical tools. And I think that's what we saw yesterday, a lot of the technical tools for amassing a community. In the Creative Commons context, we have the CC Mixter software license, or software for helping to mash up music, which is combined with the sampling licenses, creating a body of mashup artists. But if we're going to be serious about using the word commons, then we need to keep in mind certain principles that have to prevail. There have to be rules, there have to be boundaries around the community, there has to be an ability to sanction cheaters or free riders, there has to be transparent decision making, there has to be moral legitimacy among the leaders of that community. And as I said, I think music mashups are more of an open access regime than a commons per se. The commons might incidentally emerge because a lot of people share those values. But I wanted to draw to our attention, I think, really maybe the preeminent, most historic mashup community, which is the fashion world. I was involved in a conference about a year and a half ago called Ready to Share, Fashion and the Ownership of Creativity. And what's really interesting about fashion is that it is based on appropriation, recombination, remixing. That is the norm. You can't own the creative output from your apparel design. You can only own your name and trademark, name and logo, which of course is protected under trademark law. And I contend that this is precisely why the fashion industry is so creatively robust and so competitive, because nobody can sort of lock up the basic building blocks of the creative endeavor. And it's maybe, I think, the most pure remix industry that we have. And I think it shows that it's a viable industry on a global scale. I might also note, and this may surprise some of you, that the Council of Fashion Designers has recently lobbied Congress for a 3-year copyright on apparel design. And they're feeling the proprietarian impulse that is afflicting so many other communities. I think it would be devastating for the fashion industry if they ever adopted such a rule, because we see how effectively it's working right now. Fashion is I think, also robust because as a mashup, it's precisely about identity and social community as well. So it really penetrates very deeply to people. We create communities by the kinds of apparel we wear, and you know, that's part of the whole remix. I think we can start to make some correspondences between all of this and how we construct the online world. The importance of an open design commons, for creating the community, as well as for having the market work on top of the commons, so to speak, where it can provide more value added. Because I don't think that people generally realize that a market has its own significant overhead costs in terms of lawyers, marketing, distribution, retail, which essentially a community of trust and reciprocity can outcompete. It can be both more creatively robust and more efficient in an economic sense. And this is partly the theme of Yale professor Yochai Benkler's new book, The Wealth of Networks, which suggests that a commons is really a new emerging economic sector in its own right, which has to be seen as such and not just simply as an interesting, forgettable community. Rather, it can be the basis, the creation of these social communities can be the basis for entirely new types of markets with different business models. So I think that the challenge is really to recognize and protect the commons as a distinct paradigm and try to reconceptualize a lot of what's going on in the online world with that that concept. I might add that in my other lives, in non-business context, the commons is a force for getting beyond the left-right divide of our politics. I think it's also a force for asserting greater democratic accountability and civic participation. And it's also a way to assert that there are proper limits to market activity that we want to protect. So I will just leave it at that, and we can follow up with more questions.
Okay, our next panelist is John Raymer with the Intera Project.
Thank you.
We mashed them up already.
Right? Now we have to change
identity snafu, right, happening in real time here. Okay. Are you posing, or you're an imposter already?
I am an imposter. So we built what we built for the conference as a way to have this conversation, to talk about if we start to combine these resources together, what does that exercise take? So let me just restate, and for those of you who can go online, you'll see, like even yesterday, Doc Searles mentioned the live blogging, the live web. He made that distinction between the live web, you know, what's happening instantaneously. So we added that to the hub last night. So on the blogs, it's now pulling in from the Google search. So what we really wanted to do in this conference is to attempt to mesh and mash together these resources and then make it accessible for everyone to learn from. So it was in the service of this kind of conversation that all this was built. So you have there a CMS system. We took a Plone open source content management system, and that links to the MediaWiki. So if you notice, every conference session has a page associated with that as a link to the wiki that you could be editing with each other on. Jeff Marshall is the gentleman who's built Attender. So Attender is this other tool you saw yesterday, and I hope you've played with, because it's really incredible. I thought it does a great example of showing how we get to know who we are. By simply selecting a tag, you can then scroll through and see everyone who shares that tag. Then say, oh, there's somebody who has an interest that I have, I don't know, I want to meet them. So that's another resource that's there. Then Brad yesterday talked about Smartocracy. And the ability in Smartocracy is to assign proxies to other people in the community for collective decision making. And sure enough, Brad, we use the simple camel case wiki convention. So now it's possible to link from your Smartocracy to the Attender profile for that person. Now, the other thing that you're going to see later, because we're going to introduce Higgins tonight, the idea is to kind of first live a little bit in this meshed up or mashed up silos, but then what happens when user centricity gets introduced? And the whole focus for the Intera initiative is to connect our social networks to our transaction networks. For me, it was amazing when I first got into this project. The internet continues to be more and more open and open and open, but the financial networks that we engage in, I'm talking about the payments that we're making every day at the point of sale, has lived like a black box. And I had the good fortune by working on this project with Dee Hock as one of the founders of Visa to really have a chance to understand what's going on there. And you know the way Latin prescriptions are written in Latin is no accident, that doctors protect their professional powers. The black box of the financial transaction networks are complex, and they're intentionally so. And the meshing and mashing we're trying to do is to weave together our values and our social networks with our everyday purchasing. And this presents this notion of social commerce. And Intera is about shifting dollars to the common good and taking that every choice that we're making is a vote with our dollars, and you can start to redirect dollars to causes that you care about. And Brad, in addition to Smartocracy, has done other tools like Books We Like and Bluebot, which are really cool tools to let you make sure that every time you purchase, a little portion of those transactions can go to causes that you care about. Let me tell you, those of you who've built stuff, I mean, this was an incredible gift that John gave to the Intera Project to work on this thing. So you can imagine, I mean, we've been really into it. It has nothing to do with the technology. That's the illusion. It's social. It's cooperation. It's being able to understand each other. It's to be able to overcome what was known in the literature as the social dilemma. You heard the social dilemma? It's really an amazing concept. Very simple. The social dilemma is rational, individual choices that lead to poor group outcomes. It's good for my country to get all the fish out of the sea. This is, you know, we're dealing with this every day, where your own self-interest and the interest of the whole comes into play. And how do we balance those interests? So to work with each other in such a way that we can get recognized, so each person can feel as if their contribution is known. It's all about social challenges. The technology works, and when it doesn't, you have to deal with making it work. But I tell you, from my experience in doing this stuff, that this is what's going to make the difference. And, you know, there are great social inventions that happen. Things like civil rights, those aren't things that just would have happened anyway. There were people coming forward who saw a vision and declared it, and it happened. And that's what we're dealing with this user centricity. We're at a moment when our rights are at risk, when the technology is so far out in front of the people who understand the policies that they're setting, that we're so vulnerable right now. And I just want to say, don't let's get lost in the gobbledygook of all this jargon and all these technological protocols, because it's up to us to sort through the social challenges to make sure we're really doing this with our eyes wide open. So everything we built was really built in the service of this community to come to see, okay, what can we learn from what we've done here? And I urge you to, you know, use us that way. Let's inquire into what we've learned so far. For instance, there's a ton of content. If you look in that hub, every session, John broke out his best stuff. I said, John, I want you to put your content in there. Every one of these conference sessions has a page associated with related content to it. And it's accessible to you. You can do that full text Ajax cool search. It's all there. So I offer that up for us to kind of look at, like scientists, if you will, and say, okay, what did we learn about this? And I come back to saying that, you know, it's really a human phenomenon. It's a social challenge that we're facing to be able to knit together these networks. And for me, mashing and meshing is there's intentionality when you mesh. There's a relationship when you mesh, different than just mashing. So it takes a certain amount of understanding about each other and a willingness to cooperate with each other. And I think that's going to really make the difference between those things that are enduring and provide value. So I'm here to learn from what we've done together, to listen and hear what you're challenged with to be able to pull this off. I mean, we're fiddling with something we call identity. I mean, you can't get everyone to even agree on what we're talking about. There are people who insist that there is no layer, multi-dimensional model that can contain identity, that it's beyond any technological abstraction that we may choose. So we're dealing with some very, very fundamental issues. I mean, last night was an incredible expression for those who stayed to see John dancing like that with those guys. That was just so beautiful. I mean, this is what is the moment in time that's in our hands to be able to move forward in cooperative ways. And that means being able to ask people, what are your interests? What's in it for you? To get past being nice with each other, find out how do we really work together? And in that way, I offer up everything we've learned on this is for you to be able to benefit from. And don't hesitate to probe and ask. That's what we really came to be of service in that way. So,
thank you, John. Lewis?
Hi, I'm Lewis Hyde. I teach literature and creative writing at Kenyon College, but I'm also currently a fellow at the Berkman Center. And as with David Bollier, my interest has recently been the commons and trying to think about particularly cultural commons, why it matters to have the bulk of the inherited ideas and works of art that come to us not to be owned, but owned collectively. I actually think that most traditional commons have a sense of the commoner has an identity at odds with the kind of identity that's being discussed at this conference. If you look at traditional medieval agricultural commons, these are societies in which people are deeply embedded in a social network, with the emphasis on the word net, that you're enmeshed in a set of obligations and reciprocities which inhibit your motion in all directions, so that if what we're talking about here is a kind of segmented, fluid, portable identity, it's not the traditional commoner's identity. Which means that I've been thinking in a bit of a contrarian way about the discussion that we're having, and I thought my one contribution might be to talk historically a bit about some models of identity that fit the way people talk at this conference, though they don't necessarily fit the commons identity. I have a book called Trickster Makes This World, which is about the mythology of ancient trickster characters. These are the sacred liars, cheats, and thieves of mythological space. I also do a course on the confidence game, So I want to say a word about tricksters and confidence men as and the kind of identity that's involved with these characters. So one thing you learn when you read this trickster material is that these are characters like Coyote in North American Indian mythology and Hermes in Greece and Monkey in China, and there's one all over the world. And these are imagined to be characters who can encrypt their identity, who can disguise themselves and distort the image that you see. And I'll give you an example from the natural world. There is a parasite called a trypanosome. This is a protozoan that infects the blood. And the immune system has a great difficulty attacking trypanosomes because the way the immune system works is it identifies the invader and fits an antibody to the shape of the invader's skin. The trypanosome is able to change its skin. It has thousands of different ways of presenting itself so that every time the immune system figures out what it's got on its hands, the trypanosome shifts its skin and becomes a different being. So it's hard for the immune system to catch up and attack this. So this, you know, in nature there's a set of shifty-skinned animals like the flounder, which can do this, change its skin depending on where it is, or the chameleon, or in Greek letters, the octopus is the famous one. It can make itself look like the rock it's on, both in shape and color, so that then it can attack whatever approaches. So this is a kind of identity. It's a shape-shifting identity, which is hard to identify if you're the trying to pin it down. And in Greek mythology, Odysseus is associated with the octopus. When he lands on the Thracian coast, he clings to the rock like an octopus. And so the correlation is made to a certain kind of intelligence. There's an intelligence which is octopus-like, which can is versipelic. It can change its skin. It can alter its identity. And this, in the Greek tradition, is praised. So the elegiac poet Theognis says, "Present a different aspect of yourself to each of your friends. Follow the example of the octopus. Cleverness is more valuable than inflexibility." The segmented identity that I hear talking about seems to me, this is octopus territory. And the word inflexibility in Theognis in Greek is atropic. And it's useful to unpack this word. Something that's tropic, you know, a flower that's phototropic follows the sun. So tropic means, or trope is a turn of phrase. Trope means being able to turn. And the atropic then is the thing that can't turn, that's inflexible. But the opposite of that is what's called the polytropic, the thing that can turn every way. And in Greek mythology, the polytropic characters are Hermes, Odysseus, and Alcibiades. And that word gets translated into English always as versatile or wily or much traveled or cunning. And to do this briefly with Hermes, Hermes as a god in the Greek tradition is the god of thieves, of merchants, of travelers, of rhetoric, and so forth. He's the sacred boundary crosser. He can move from one space to another. So he's polytropic in the sense of being able to set himself into any situation to become this and adapt himself to it. And actually, the earliest we have in English the word hermeneut, which means somebody who's skilled at interpreting texts. But this comes from Hermes, and the earliest meaning of hermeneus is a translator. So you have to imagine Hermes moving from one situation to another, moving from France to Italy to Greece to Serbo-Croatia, and being able to speak each language as he sets down in each country. So that the translator and the traveler are the same thing in this image, and the hermeneutic intelligence is the intelligence that's able to move from sphere to sphere and translate from one thing to another. This becomes the model of interpretation in with the understanding that any text has layers of meaning. And so in medieval rhetoric, it's imagined there's a moral meaning and a mystical meaning and a literal meaning and so forth, and you're a hermeneut who's able to move from a meaning space to meaning space and be able to figure them out. This is a kind of identity, is the hermeneutic identity or the polytropic identity. And let me jump from this to American letters. In the 1850s, the word confidence game and confidence man is an American invention. If you look in a historical dictionary, it first appears in the 1850s. Of course, there are confidence men in the ancient world too, but that particular formulation of it, a guy shows up in New York City trying to get people to loan him money on his watch or something like this, and he gets called the confidence man. And then Herman Melville picks this up and writes a novel called The Confidence Man. A couple of quick things to say about the confidence. For a confidence game to work, several things have to be in place. Actually, I should back off and give you a nice open definition of a confidence man. A confidence man is somebody who is in the business of creating belief, which is to say, he isn't necessarily a crook. That is, he could be a prophet. He could be the true thing. Or he could be trying to steal your wallet. You don't know. I liked the point yesterday in one of the panels that identity is a dual phenomenon. It's both an assertion and an assessment, that there is a two-way street here. And so in the confidence game, the identity game is I make an assertion, and I'm trying to get you to believe in it. And on the same your position is you are trying to assess the assertion, should I believe in this? So should I extend my credulity to you or not? And the reason it's a game and a puzzle is that sometimes these assertions are true. Sometimes, actually, in confidence games, they come true if you believe. a famous confidence game in the 19th century was to say, we are going to build a new town in Minnesota. It's called New Harmony. And here's the map with the flowing water fountain and the public library and so forth. And in fact, if enough people believed in this town, New Harmony, Minnesota would appear. So you can create the future if you believe, or you can have your wallet stolen. It's a puzzle. For the criminal confidence game to work, what you really need is decontextualization. That is, the fewer cues you have to the context of the person making the assertion, the higher the probability that you might be fooled. And so this begins to appear in America as America becomes urbanized. If you live in a small town and you know everybody's history, it's less likely you're going to be taken in. But if you're New York City is the ecosystem that produces the confidence man in the 1850s. If you have no temporal cues, you don't know the history, and you have no local cues, it's very hard to figure out what's going on. There's an interesting run of advice manuals in the 19th century about how to deal with this problem. And the advice generally is, you should look for people who are sincere and for people who are transparent in their assertions of who they are. And you yourself should be sincere and transparent. Transparency is one of the themes that runs through this 19th century literature, and I hear it in this conference. The problem with this is it's an infinite regression. That is, the skillful, crooked confidence man can imitate sincerity and transparency ad infinitum. So you would like to believe that there is such a thing as pure transparency and real sincerity, and that you could see into somebody's heart and know who they really are. But it turns out to be difficult to do in practice. And which brings me to Melville's Confidence Man book, because it's a wonderful thought experiment about identity. The way this book works is it's set on a Mississippi River boat, so highly decontextualized. Passengers keep getting on and off. And there seems to be a single character who appears in 13 or 14 different guises and gulls people out of their money, though sometimes he gives money to people, so he's not necessarily a crook. The problem is you never see him except in one of his masks. That is to say, every time you see him, he's playing a role. So who is the confidence man? What is his true identity? It's very hard to assert. If people say the same thing about Odysseus. When you see somebody masking themselves, it implies an actual identity behind the mask, but actually you are the person who is imputing that. And in the Melville novel, you could say finally that the identity of the confidence man is only found in the shifting masks. There is no buried identity. So in a certain sense, the self in this imaginative exercise is empty. It doesn't exist. There is no self you can put your finger on. And now, again, actually, to go back to the shifty animals, in a way, this is a good protection. Clippinger's paper on the immune system is nice this way. He says, what the immune system does is to notice what I'm not. some bug invades me and the immune system says, well, I'm not that, and tries to kill it. But it never asserts what you are. Because to the degree that you assert what you are, you become vulnerable to attack. And so the confidence man has a similar empty center, which can't be attacked because there's nothing there. There's no thing you can pin your shoot your arrow at. I actually would like to say that, you know, Melville is a great skeptic about this. So you have a sort of the negative tradition in American letters around this image. If you go to Emerson, I think you get the same thing, only it's asserted as a positive. That the self in an Emersonian world is polytropic. It's able to adopt many masks, many roles. I'll read you this little, in Self-Reliance, there's a little image of, he says, a sturdy lad from New Hampshire or Vermont who in turn tries all the professions, who teams it, farms it, peddles, keeps a school, preaches, edits a newspaper, goes to Congress, buys a township, and so forth in successive years, and always like a cat, falls on his feet, is worth 100 of these city imposters. He walks abreast with his days. He feels no shame in not studying for a profession. He does not postpone his life, but lives it. So this is an image of the American who's able to do anything, but actually takes none of the things he does seriously as my thing. That is, he's the master of all trades, but mastered by none. So in a funny way, the way you get to know the American self in Emerson is by the things it does and then rejects. I'm a school man, you know, I teach college, but then I quit. And it's the quitting of the thing you were that makes you a true American. So again, it's a constant rejection of images or identities, so as to form an identity which is grounded in the negation of all other identities. I'm going to end with one little story about P.T. Barnum. P.T. Barnum's museum in New York people say, in a way, what Barnum did was to domesticate the confidence game. He put it into a space where the anxiety of it was reduced and you could get to play at the confidence game. So the thing about Barnum's museum was it had two kinds of exhibits. Some of them were fake and some of them were real. And you could be made a fool of in two different ways. You could be made a fool of by thinking the fake things were real, but you could also be made a fool of by thinking the real things were fake. So they had the Fiji mermaid, this was fake, and they had the duck-billed platypus, this was real. And so in a way, and this is true in the Melville novel too, there are two mistakes to make. One is being too credulous, and one is being too skeptical. Between these two categories lies hermeneutic wit, lies a kind of intelligence which knows that reading identity is always difficult. There is no way to make it sure. And therefore, you need to develop a kind of intelligence around the complexity of identity formation if you're to survive in this world. I think this works nicely for the user-centric. That is to say, it's handy if I'm going back to this idea that I can protect myself, that I have adaptability if I have this polytropic intelligence, because nobody can kind of come at me. If I can segment my identity, assert it here and here, and not have somebody aggregated and come at me, it's safer. I don't know how it works when you're trying to catch criminals. Maybe you have to live with a certain level of criminality.
Okay.
I can go on.
Very much. Jake?
Who put me after Lewis Hyde? David, you're going to have to use your hermeneutic wit to pull it all back together.
I'm thinking about it right now. End of the session. Got a beat on that, but maybe we'll get some help from the audience.
So I'll keep it quick so we can actually get into a discussion. You know, one of the things I was thinking of is, of course, the trying to tie together the concepts of mashups and identity. I'm Jake Shapiro. I'm executive director of the Public Radio Exchange. I'm a fellow at the Berkman Center. I'm lead guitarist for a group called Two Ton Shoe, which is a rock band based here in Boston. And you know, sort of the mashups we're most familiar with are our own identities, the sort of fields and passions and projects and communities that we're part of. So those are some of mine. I for a while lived in Moscow, Russia, speak Russian and had studied that and lived there in 1993 to 1996. came back to Boston, started a rock band called Two Ton Shoe, and sort of done a lot of stuff online with that in the early days on mp3.com and sort of self-distribution and trying to take advantage of the technologies that were empowering independent artists to connect with others and reach their own audiences. I got involved in public radio, where I was a producer on The Connection at WBUR with Christopher Lydon in its heyday, sort of the last year before it exploded in a firebomb of real trouble with the station, which was also a show, you know, sort of before the sort of explosion of the blogosphere that I think had tapped into this notion of a symbiotic relationship between a kind of media source, a mass media source, and an audience wanting to interact with it, which is a topic I'd like to return to. And then I got scooped into the Berkman Center. I mean, I think, you know, if being a true American is quitting the things that you were, I've done that, you know, now several times in a row, which I think is something that we all have had this sort of phased approach to. And then one of the sort of mashup pleasures that come back is when some of those past commitments or identities suddenly resurface. One of the ways that it resurfaced for me recently, even though the band hasn't been that active, is that those MP3s that we put online back in, you know, 1998 and eventually reposted under Creative Commons licenses, we noticed there were a lot of downloads happening, you know, across the world. We had a few in Italy and a few in Brazil and then a bunch more in Korea. And we got this phone call about a year ago from Kwon Ho Il in South Korea, saying that he had noticed there were a lot of downloads in Korea, and he has a record label there, independent label, and wanted to see if we would put out our record in South Korea, license it to him, which I thought it was a con man. I thought that was a confidence man giving me, because there's no way that was happening. But it was indeed, and you know, I didn't, you know, we've learned from being an independent rock band not to believe anything until the check arrives and it's in the bank and clears. You stop telling people about that label that's interested in you. You know, none of those stories work. But it happened. The check arrived. We licensed our music to them. They put out a double CD in South Korea. It started to sell pretty well. We found online this. Found somebody who was offering guitar instructional video on the parts that I'd written for some of the songs in Korean. And they decided, and you know, South Korea is an enormously wired country, and you know, in fact, such that the P2P file sharing for music has completely debilitated the CD sales. So the way that the labels make money is through live performances. So they flew us over. They said, "Why don't you come over? You're doing all right. Let's fly you over to Seoul." So last August we got on a plane, and four of us, no entourage, no you know, managers, no roadies, unfortunately, and went over to Seoul. And it turns out we were rock stars in Seoul. We did four sold out shows, two on public television, two in these clubs. The kids showed up, knew all the words to the songs, had learned it all through, you know, this sort of downloading of it, and through some of the record label promotion. And that became, you know, a true, you know, it was an identity mashup for all of us in a way that was a profoundly real one, if not a little bit Spinal Tap-ish, which we do totally admit to that part of it. And then I came back and continued working on the Public Radio Exchange, which is my main activity, which sort of ties into the topics here as well. PRX is an online community and marketplace for public radio producers and stations. It's really kind of a B2B service. That enables any creator of audio, and we're talking here about mainly public radio style things like documentaries and commentaries and features and music profiles and interviews and that kind of thing, to upload their work to a peer-reviewed process where we do sort of post-filtering. It's, you know, creating a long-tail archive of radio works that have otherwise often been falling off the radar screen or unavailable, and inviting both professionals within the industry as well as listeners to come in and help review and rate, listen to the work, which then becomes available, or then is immediately available to our main buyers, which are radio stations. So local public radio stations around the country come to PRX to find work to download, to put on air. It's a nonprofit that's trying to change and sort of reshape the way that public radio is actually working and the way some of these network nodes are created, change the relationship between the creators, the broadcasters, and the listeners, which we've really started to see happening. And as I think about the mashups that interest me, it's in the media field. It's in my field, public media, public broadcasting, which itself is kind of going through an identity crisis. You know, it's done remarkably well as an industry. Public radio is reaching 30 million people a week, and public television is reaching 80 million people a week. And opposed to all the flattening lines of other mass media, the public media lines have trended fairly well. But it's no longer sort of operating in a scarce environment where the access to or interaction to or sort of means of connecting with ideas and culture and education and some of the things that were sort of the preserve of public broadcasting are the case. And this notion that perhaps participatory models have greater potential for fulfilling the public mission, the civic mission of what public broadcasting is about, poses a great opportunity but a real challenge. And the idea that the sort of notion of trust and identity, the sort of to the extent that our identities are media created and media formed and against the backdrop of consuming and sort of dwelling in media, figuring out what kind of a critical role public media continues to play and how it could shift if a mashup approach or culture starts to really make a much more porous border. As we see, I mean, I think some of the mashups that are most common, as opposed to sort of the newly emerging data-driven kind of Google Map mashups, are, of course, the blogospheric mashups that are really commenting on, reacting to, integrating with the news. You know, sites like Dig or, you know, Newsvine, which is starting up, and certainly just individual blogs that are pulling out bits of news from everywhere and trying to react to that. There's sort of an open feed of that kind of material out there, and part of what I'm hoping the PRX will do and what public broadcasting will embrace is the idea that that actually is the role, is the path that could create a much richer experience with audiences that are no longer audiences but are ones that are actually creating and contributing to the media and leveraging what is still quite a mass media phenomenon. You know, public radio did this exercise where, you know, thinking of identity, they went out and did a bunch of focus groups with listeners around the country, sitting down in rooms like this with, you know, 10 people behind a glass and sort of asking them, you know, because they wanted to get it right, figure out why is it that you listen to public radio? What draws you? What are you listening to? And they came up with this, they distilled the language down to some actual terms, which they then call core values. And program directors for radio stations have these printed on these laminated cards. That they're actually, you know, if they have them at conferences and they hand them out, they carry them around. It's sort of a convenient way to help judge programming that they're just considering putting on their station or that they're producing. I thought it'd be interesting to read a couple of them. So this is what they heard back from listeners and becomes part of the identity of the sound and presumably some of the identity of the people who are in the audience. And this is in three categories: qualities of the mind, love of lifelong learning, substance, credibility, accuracy, honesty, respect for the listener, and purpose. Qualities of the heart: humor, idealism, inspired about public life and culture, civility in the belief in civil discourse, and generosity. And then the last is qualities of the craft, which is a uniquely human voice, pacing and attention to detail. It's just interesting to hear when we sort of talk about, we're always sort of searching for filters and trusted filters and what are the qualities that we're thinking about as we see completely new, you know, networked information economies now becoming the ways in which we consume and reach media. This actually being kind of a code that's emerged and one that, you know, that in the field I take issue with, because in many ways these are core values that only are a self-perpetuating one that reacts to what the audience is telling us they want to hear. And that's one out of, you know, nine people who listen to public radio. The other eight out of nine aren't resonating with those values, and I'm interested to find out, instead of what the core values, what the fringe values might be. So back to you, David. I just thought I'd make it even harder for you to connect all the dots.
Well, I'm going to connect them, and we'll do a little remixing here, yeah, if you don't mind. I think what was, you know, when you listen to everybody who just spoke, what's most interesting to me is it sort of represents a very a spectrum. And so I wanted to try to define the spectrum. Okay, so a plus and a minus. Okay, on what? It goes from positive to negative. So, for example, if we want to put John Raymer here on the closest end of the positive end of the spectrum, here's a guy who's just like, we're here to learn. We think there's an amazing amount of potential here, and we don't even know what it is. Help us figure it out. And by the way, we're going to contribute too, and they've made a huge contribution. It's all about the promise of dealing with identity in a variety of contexts. Then you have David sitting next to me, who is sort of a little bit on the positive side, and just in some ways talks about ideas about Creative Commons and stuff like that. Well, there are some tools that you need before you're gonna do this positive stuff. You know, you got to think about some intellectual property issues. And by the way, those are very real, because if you start mashing up two things that have different like licenses to the data, you get yourself into a lot of trouble, as I've learned from a few people. Then we have Jake, who is sort of a practitioner. He's kind of like said, you know, the heck with the rules and the potential. I'm just going to go do it. And he's done it. And now he's got, you know, in a variety of different contexts, whether it's National Public Radio or it's his rock band, you know, there has been some real usage of a mashup or a meshup context, if you want to say that. He has several personas. He's a rock star in Korea. He's a rock star in a different way here on the Harvard campus. But I'm sure if we go to some small city in the middle of the Midwest, nobody will know who Jake is, unfortunately. And so he's experienced. He also kind of went through that kind of like, is this guy a con man? You know, he's living that kind of like, well, I want to do the positive, but there's the risk involved. And then finally, you know, we have Lewis, who is all about the risks. You know, it's like, this guy could really be taking your money for you. You know, he's a con man, you know. Look out, you know. And so I think what this does is it sort of paints a picture of when we look at all of these things that have yet to be figured out, this general view that there's so much promise, so much potential, but there's so much risk. You know, it's uncharted water. And what do we do? You know, how do we approach this? And by the way, we're only five people up here who can give you some context of the way we've kind of touched the identity ecosystem. And what I'd really like to do is I'd like to hear, I think maybe our panelists would love to hear about some of your unique contextual engagements with the identity ecosystem, just so maybe it can give us more perspective, but also share some really great anecdotal stuff with the room. Does that make a lot of sense?
Yes.
I mean, we've heard a lot of anecdotal stories here, some of them mythological, others not. Who wants to go first? Don't everybody raise their hand at once. Okay,
and
we got to.
You should use the mic. I think they're recording. So
yeah, you step up to the microphone. We're going to make it even more.
I was listening to the podcast from a South by Southwest session, and you know when they don't, they go to Q&A, and you have 5 minutes of silence in the middle.
So first, identify yourself or not.
I'm Brad DeGraff. Jake, did it occur to you that maybe two-ton shoe means something in Korean?
We thought about that. Yeah, we were worried we'd show up and it'd be all like guys dressed in leather or something. Like, what is it? It might mean something truly wrong.
You can sort of hear it in the language. Two-ton shoe,
yeah.
Actually, one of the things I haven't heard much, this is just an observation, but in terms of assertion of identity, I think one of the really valuable ways to make this more fluid and work better is mutual assertion. You know, I know John Raymer, you know, and if there's a trusted way that I can say, yeah, that is John Raymer. When he asserts that he is, that identity is John Raymer, I agree that that is him. And obviously that depends on me being somebody that I say I am. But I think that there's a lot of interesting potential mutual validation that could actually lubricate a lot of this stuff.
It's really interesting you mentioned mutual validation because, you know, in the open source world, going back to what David spoke about, little bit is that there's also this rule of mutually assured destruction, right? You break the license, and I'm going to break it on you. I mean, this happens routinely in open contexts. If you violate the open context, then you yourself are excluded from the open system. I don't know.
One of the themes of the commons as a governance structure is finding mechanisms to assure that you can police it so that the confidence man cannot destroy it, and so. I mean, that's why it's important to distinguish between an open access regime where you can do whatever the hell you want and a commons where there are rules, where there are people who have different roles for patrolling, monitoring, to make sure, in a way, it is the mutual assertion of identity and assigned roles and rights.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Two things to say. First of all, I think, yes, that part of the project
given the element of risk in identity recognition, is to come up with methods to give you some hermeneutic leverage. So you get better and better at reading something, and so this would be one way to do it, that with mutual identification, you begin to have some confidence, okay, there seems to be a community here. But I again think that this is a potential infinite regression, because there's a character called the shill who shows up and mutually recognizes the person doing the con game. And you can even have a community of shills.
Are you calling Brad a shill for me here?
I don't know. I don't know. He could be a shill for you. In fact, I'm interested that you know his name.
Three card Monty is...
three card Monty, you know, one guy keeps winning, and you think, well, clearly you can win at this game.
Well, eBay has that problem in spades. Yeah. They found ways to deal with it. But I think that's what technology is good for, is solving those problems. And you can only fake that stuff so much.
So, any other... I'll tell a story, just to warm things up, because maybe it'll spark some inspire some people to tell their own story. You know, we talk about some of the early, you know, instantiations, if you will, or examples of mashups or commons where information is being shared, merged together. A recent exploration of my personal genealogy revealed what I thought was maybe one of the roots of the blogosphere. And in some ways, a bit of a mashup. How many people know what a Yitzker book is?
Yitzker?
A Yitzker book.
Yeah, I do.
Okay, great. So, one of the things is, you know, if you're Jewish, as I am, you can't really explore your genealogy without exploring your heritage at the same time. What I mean by that is your religious heritage. You know, my wife is Dutch, and when she explores her genealogy, it's an exploration. It would be an exploration of her nationality. Okay, whereas with Jews, it's a little bit different. Nationality is, the religion is the nationality. And so when I started to kind of go back and say, well, I knew there was some piece of my family that was lost, you know, that we don't know where they are, what something happened to them, we weren't sure. And so I really started to dig deep, and I traced through the database on Ellis Island, I traced my family members back to a town that's now in the Ukraine called Bedayetsa. And it turns out that back in that part of Europe, Eastern Europe, is called Galicia. That the Jewish life was scattered all across Europe in these little tiny clusters called shtetls. And a Yitzker book described life in the shtetl. And it was written, everybody who was in the shtetl contributed to it, or not everybody, but a group of people who thought, you know, this is a good idea, would contribute to these Yitzker books. And so if you know, one of the interesting things about the Holocaust is that there is, because of the reparations that have been paid out by several countries, there is an enormous amount of funding that goes behind the reconstruction of identities. Okay, and so this is really interesting about identities, because a lot of those identities are just simply lost, vanished off the face of the earth, and there's so much money being poured in to find out, hey, what are the identities of these people? Were they related to anybody who's still alive? And people can conduct these searches and try to, you know, research data. And one of the sources of information, you know, and this maybe say something about, you know, what we're building today online and socially, are the Yitzker books. Now, they're all in Yiddish, so a lot of the money that's coming from out of the, you know, these reparation monies are being applied to the translation of the Yitzker books into English, because when you read through them, you start to discover bits and pieces of information about the identities of people who lived in these shtetls. And so just to kind of put a more poignant end on that story, the Yitzker book for the town that my family hails from, Bedayetsa, is three quarters away through being translated. It was just, and I get an email every time a new chapter gets translated. And it was just through recent, one of the recent translations, I actually discovered some information about my family members that, you know, you see your family members being mentioned in the book. But even more importantly is that, you know, by doing this research, digging back, finding information, I went into this database that's run by, there's a large site that you can go to called jewishgen.org, where, you know, it just basically points to everything that's possibly related to your genealogy and Jewish history. and I put into a database that here are three names I'm researching. And what the database does is it comes back and it tells you if anybody else is researching those three names, because then there's a potential match, right? And we knew a piece of the family was missing. What happened was one part of our family, a bunch of them left. Well, a bunch of them came to the U.S., but some stayed behind. And then they had children, and some of the children during World War II escaped to the French underground, but the others stayed behind and were killed and buried in a mass grave outside of the town of Podyatsa. Well, the people that were missing were the ones who escaped the French underground. Well, it turned out that another person who was researching the three names was the grandson of the guy who escaped to the French underground, and we found each other. I've written about this on ZDNet. I said 60 years later, the internet triumphs over evil, because what the Holocaust did was it broke families apart. It completely devastated families and people. My wife's family, in fact, even though she's Dutch, her mother, her grandmother, incarcerated in a concentration camp in Indonesia, and so. When you think about how it tore families apart, now, by virtue of this technology, identities are being recreated in the way that we originally existed, and families are actually being sewn back together. So, good. So I inspired a hand. So here we go. Michael, you could go to the microphone and identify yourself or not.
Truthfully. My name is Michael Rand. And I just thought I would add some items to your story, because I think, in a way, you've hit on something that I think, if amplified, can relate to what we're doing here. There's this organization in Israel called Yad Vashem, which is responsible for the remembering the Holocaust in Israel. And they created a database, or they're trying to create a database of all the people that are missing. And they've had a million hits on this. It's accessible through the internet on it. So, I mean, there's a tremendous popularity, and it goes beyond just the particular here, the Jewish community. I don't know the exact statistic, but I think genealogical research is one of the most popular uses of the internet. And, there was just an article in the New York Times about how people are taking swabs of their genetic material, sending it to companies, and finding out that they're related to Genghis Khan through, DNA and so forth. And, I was thinking, in a way, perhaps, we as human beings are the ultimate mashup. I mean, Jews are one example, but, we're having a whole big debate in America, who's an American, because of this issue. Is there such thing as a pure American, or is someone who jumps over the fence in Mexico and then, works and so forth, are they American? How long do they have to stay here? How long of a mashup do they have to be before they come into existence?
Well, I think one of the great things about the internet is that, in some ways, it's an attempt to deconstruct the mashup, right? You're trying to say, well, here I am, I'm this person, but where did I come from? And that's that. I really got the answers to that question, in a major way. Not only did the answers, I found part of my family. So, and that helps you know where you come from. So I think,
One other tidbit. When the Ellis Island web database went online, it crashed because so many people were trying to access it that they couldn't keep up with demand. And, so again, it's Jewish people, but also other people are trying to deal with this reality.
How many people have accessed the Ellis Island database? It's really worth accessing if you think that you have people who came over from the old country. It's quite an amazing database, and the only thing I would add is that if you're looking for relatives in it, be patient and try different spellings, because none of my relatives, I could not find one single same spelling of a relative. My own relatives that are here alive in the United States have different spellings than other relatives here in the U.S., and then those are different from what was in the Ellis Island database. And I can imagine some guy just scribbling, because you actually see the manifests are written. They didn't have computers back then, by the way. Typewriters or anything like that. They're all handwritten, and so you have to kind of scan this handwriting and try to. So you can see some guy who's just saying, "What's your name?" and writing whatever makes sense.
Recently I heard an interview with Ken Burns. and he was saying that the work he did on the Civil War was possible, you know, the documentary on Civil War, because of all the handwritten letters. And the risk we run because of all this information on the internet is the formats will become obsolete. And they won't be able to reconstruct the conversations of our generation as easily as the persistence of paper has lasted that way. It's just a... because it was such an intimate story to read all those letters. You know?
Well, this is actually gets to cuts to a whole other problem and a challenge with identity, particularly as we try... You know, you say the technology really doesn't matter, but in some ways... you have to, you know, that's sort of like IT doesn't matter, right? Where's Nick Carr? Is he in the room? There are some things, though, to keep an eye on with respect to how this evolves in a technological context, which is that when we talk about proprietary technologies, you could very easily end up siloing identity in a way that you can't mash identity back together the way it should be if your identity is spread across the internet. And by the way, there are plenty of companies and vendors who want it that way. I mean, you take Apple, for example, and I just want to point out one thing. What you may not know is they run an identity management system. When you buy a song from iTunes Music Store, it's tied to your identity. And your identity is keyed off your credit card. And they have a way of saying, who is David Berlin? But guess what? You will never see that identity system. That can't be mashed up with anything. It's locked away somewhere. It's very proprietary. And the way it bubbles up into the real world is that, okay, so this music is tied... My right to use this music, and maybe David, you can comment on this. My right to use this music is tied to my identity, but guess what? Apple's holding that right, and I can't transfer that right to something that doesn't belong to Apple. Try taking a song that you purchased on the iTunes Music Store and legally, without breaking the law, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which outlaws the circumvention of copy protection, and try putting it on an iRiver device or a Creative device. You can't do it. And the reason you can't do it is because Apple is the custodian of your identity and the association of your right to a specific piece of content with that identity.
Well, I think there's something fundamentally repugnant about identity being commodified and fungible like that, which I think a lot of people are reacting to in creating communities. And this discussion reminds me of Sherry Turkle's remark that the internet has enacted postmodernism in our lives. And the fact that our identities are strewn across cyberspace, one could say that this intense interest in identity is precisely about trying to reaggregate our sense of identity, which has been dispersed and indeed commodified and sold by a lot of people. So I think that's really interesting about, there's the Identity Commons group represented here. I think they are perhaps honing in on a certain zeitgeist impulse to try to reaggregate and consolidate an identity on a commons basis.
Right. I just think, as noble as everybody's intentions are in this room and at this conference, we have to bear in mind that there are other forces working against these exact intentions.
Yeah. You know, it might have been before the caffeine kicked in that I said the technology doesn't matter.
I don't know if those were your exact words, but...
I just say, my point is that it could be used to obscure the challenge that we face, which is a social challenge. I mean, we talk about meshing up. The Intera initiative recognized it takes the head, the heart, and the hands. And that knowing is doing. And that the theory of all this stuff, as important as it is, has to show up in practice. And that's just what was my point, is that let's not let all of the protocols and mm-hmm. challenges that we face technologically, which are real and important,
weigh us down.
You know, but you really want to make things happen is when we start to cooperate with each other. That's when new things can get invented and the conversation can be forwarded.
Amanda?
Yeah. I want to bring up an example that comes from work that I did in the past. Before I came to the Berkman Center, I worked on political campaigns, the Deed and Carry campaigns.
Who are you, so everybody knows?
My name is Amanda Mickel, and I worked on the Deed and Carry internet teams, and then I'm at the Berkman Center now. And one of the big questions post-Deed and Carry campaigns was which campaign did a better job doing grassroots organizing. And a lot of people just looked online to see what groups were still in existence, taking that as evidence of a better manifestation of the grassroots. But what was overlooked is that on the Dean campaign, the campaign had architecture for people to organize, but many people actually organized off-site. And so when the campaign ended, people were still in contact with one another. They continued to work together. Whereas on the Kerry campaign, many people actually moved to the campaign's infrastructure. And on the night of the election, we had to flip the switch because we couldn't pay for things past midnight. And so what happened was that everyone who was involved in the campaign, who came to know people through the campaign, lost all their information.
Wow.
And if you think about, I mean, in terms of politics, there's a big question about what is responsibility of the party? What kind of infrastructure does the party have to put in place? In an environment that's tremendously fluid, where most people are actually in contact with the parties through campaigns, you can imagine an environment in which people's identities are in, not just in constant flux, but in constant regeneration. Because with each and every campaign, you have to reintroduce yourself and recreate networks, which is why right now, my suspicion is many people are actually moving off-site because it's just too cumbersome. And campaigns are, to an extent, compensating for the fact that it costs so much to pull people onto all their resources by doing more direct mail, direct email. But that's a good example, I think, in which you can start to see in just a very short period of time how it affects dynamics, resources, infrastructure.
About identity, look at what happened to Al Gore now with this film. I mean, how many people said, boy, that's the guy you wish you would have had as president. And the film has had such an enormous effect on his identity and our thoughts about him, the way he's written about and talked about.
He may not even be running, but he will win the popular vote again.
Right.
How about some other stories? I mean, how many people feel as though their identity is already so disaggregated that there's no hope of reaggregating it? I mean, when you think about where your identity... I know, like, I've got, like, 3 blogs... several sites where I bank at Delicious. I'm on and that's apart from all these. So how many people does anybody stress out about that? I know I do.
I call it the scarecrow effect. Remember the Wizard of Oz? A little piece of me's over here. A little piece of me's over there.
I have a question for Lewis, which is based on when you go back through history, when new things enable new tricks. What can we expect? I mean, when you think about a mashup, right? I mean, if we go back to what Jeff Marshall did with Hot or Not and Google Maps, you know, that scared the daylights out of some people. Other people thought it was cool, right? So how much of that ahead of us do you think we see where we don't know the ways in which this will be used by the shills and the conmen? Are we really in sort of like, you know, with the wild, wild west where we're not sure what Indian awaits us on the side of the other ridge?
Well, I mean, generically, that is one way to describe a lot of the history of confidence games, is that each new technology comes along and disrupts our sense of how we are connected and work with each other and needs to be absorbed and domesticated. So that as soon as you get...
Need some of David's rules.
But the technologies tend to drop on us without any rules. And so suddenly for example, birth control coming in the 1950s, suddenly there's a method to control fertility, which we never had. And then it takes 20 or 30 years to figure out, you know, to rearrange gender roles and understandings about how we live our lives, given that we have this powerful new tool. And the same seems to be true of the internet technology. I mean, one feature of this also is that it tends to be moments in which certain people get very rich. The invention of the internal combustion engine made, you know, people were sitting on oil and thought, oh, I've got crummy farmland, were suddenly able to make themselves rich in a way they hadn't been before. The same with, the first people to sort of stake out claims in software became rich beyond the dreams of Croesus.
Is there a cycle here? You know, sort of like, okay, technology comes along, it disrupts things, we get a whole bag of new tricks, and then governance comes in, we got to introduce some governance to kind of restrict the tricks, and then all of a sudden new technology comes along, and the question is that cycle compressing to the point that the governance can't catch up, quite frankly? I mean, when you look at what's happening in our government today, I can look at the patent office, you can look in the court system, and you can see that in some ways governance is way behind.
Absolutely. I mean, the watershed moment in this generation is digital copying, which, you know, on the one hand, you have this panicked, aggressive attack from the old content owners who try to use the old rules to contain what used to be an easily contained copying system, and the rest of us who find it's, you know, realize that there have to be a new set of protocols because copying has changed. It was easy to control the flow when you had clunky things called books that were sticky, object-based inventory, and it's become impossible to do now. So
the question.
And in a way, this whole identity thing is around trying to come up with new tools and rules for managing a system that needs. You know, we have not yet figured out how to do identity on the internet. This is why it's such a useful conversation.
So we'll go to the question in a second. But yeah. for David, how do you see this? If I'm somebody who's going to publish information on the out there to be mashed up, but I don't know the new bag of tricks that's coming that could take that and use it in nefarious ways. What's the best approach to managing whatever it is however it is you're expressing your identity? What how do you, there's a bunch of people in this room that probably want to know that. Like, how do I safely engage in a way that I'm not going to get, taken to the cleaners, so to say?
Well, I mean, I think as Lewis says, these are all in flux and in negotiation. I think it'll be, we haven't gotten there yet, but it'll be the combining of the technological tools, the legal innovations which are still underway, the licenses and so forth, and the social norms, and all of those coming together. I mean, I'm working on a book on the Creative Commons, and so it's much on my mind about how a lot of that stuff is coming together in terms of the meta tagging, the social communities, the legal regimes, and who knows, we might be reaching a certain equilibrium or at least some stable points in those kind of communities.
I guess the reason I ask the question is like, can you rely on some protective governance context that exists today? And maybe, Jake, you have some ideas about this too, because you're a national, NPR is, specializes in this sort of open media area, but let's say I love the idea of Creative Commons, but maybe it just creates too loose of an environment, where I don't know what's going to happen if I license my identity, any of my metadata under that. So I'm more inclined to use copyright, knowing that, hey, if somebody misuses something I put out there, then I can sue them, and maybe the fear of that of me suing them will keep them from misusing my. I mean, that kind of works against everything that we're trying to do here, but at the same time, if we're saying that that this is a risky area right now to be engaged with, then you have to kind of keep whatever protection mechanisms you can keep in place.
Well, one, you can still sue, and two, it's probably counterproductive in the networked environment to have the strict copyright, which is the issue. But mm-hmm. Let's hear from Jacob on that score.
I think that the risks are in some cases overestimated, and mostly economic versus creative or real. I mean, I think that, I think about it too in terms of the creative output. Producers or artists who are creating songs or works that are then subject to being remixed or mashed up, it's sort of interesting to think about how their identities are kind of encoded into these works that then propagate out, and that they're very, a lot of people are very concerned about the ways that the contexts and that those might be remixed and mashed up in, and even if they're very much in favor of the kind of networked culture, when it comes down to the idea of their work being changed, they get worried about it. But I think usually, the fact of the matter is that some of these music mashups, when I was on a panel with Creative Commons when they were unveiling their remix license, and part of what was clear is that, a lot of the remixes, first of all, there's not as many people remixing as you'd think there would be, and a lot of them are pretty bad, the ones that they come up with. And the ones that are good, you tend to learn about it, and those you can kind of celebrate it. But the fears over sort of like, the hate speech is going to infiltrate these things and completely, destroy the sort of trusted relationship I have with my audience ends up not being something as much of a factor. There's great concern, of course, in the news business about the ways in which those things are happening, and NPR being a good example, in that, they really do, their notion of authenticity and trust is based on, journalistic standards and the huge kind of capacity and investment they've made in that, and the thought that the ground is shifting from under them, where that actually is completely changing what it is that somebody, why suddenly podcasting has taken off, and in many ways people are resonating with this kind of authenticity you hear in a much less formal, much less structured, much less produced environment. What pressures that puts on them to think differently about what they lend their content to.
Turn it over to the audience.
Excuse me, can I
sure, but you can.
Well, there's the one guy. He's been standing at the microphone for a while. So can you go after?
Go to the microphone. So
yeah, go up after. Yeah.
Just get up on.
Huh?
No. I forgot.
Sorry about that.
No, no, it's okay. Sort of back to what the conversation you started that Lewis responded to, and the issue of your identity being sort of atomized and trying to pull it back in. I mean, one of the issues is just the permanence of the web. I mean, and you put one thing out there, and it's there forever, and you know it's probably on the Wayback Machine, and you know that. You know, I think the kids using MySpace now are realizing are going to be a little more careful about what they put up just because of the whole issue.
Okay, let me give you a very real story that goes on that gets
anyway,
to that.
It's an observation.
A long time ago, my father contacts me. If you want to go up, you go next. A long time ago, my father he calls me up and he says, "Turns out I have low-grade lymphoma, but they caught it early. But I have some of these other health problems, and I can't find anybody who knows anything about it." So I found this news group, internet news group. This is before the web, you know. And I went out to the news group that was all about, like, where these doctors share ideas and stuff like that. And I said, "Hey, you know, my dad's got these symptoms. Does anybody know what this is, right? You know, he's been diagnosed with low-grade lymphoma." Now, in his business, he really doesn't want anybody to know that he's got low-grade lymphoma, because it could affect how well he, you know, people may take a different view of him in his business. Now, news groups, almost nobody, unless you're really like technologically, it was kind of a protected environment. Well, then years later, somebody goes and converts all the news groups onto the web. So now they're not only are they accessible, more widely accessible, but they're easily searchable. And so by just putting in, you know, somebody put his name in, they came across this thing where I was saying my dad's got cancer, blah, 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 blah. And the next thing you know, I get a note from my dad. "What is this on the web about me?" Very upset with me. You know, and so that's what I'm talking about, you know, you don't know when you put something out there, you know, how it's, you know, what the future holds, given the way the direction that technology is taking.
I think about, you know, candidates for future office. You know, they think about the Bush's youthful indiscretions that he was able to basically brush over, or the ones where Bill Clinton in 1968 was carefully, he knew enough, he was writing a letter, you know, understanding that he was trying to preserve his future political viability and carefully wording things at the time where he was writing documents. But most of the kids in MySpace, I don't think, are thinking about that.
I'm sorry, so...
No, it's okay. Good morning. My name is Adriana Rizzotto. I'm from Brazil. And I'm very concerned about the intersection between copyrights and the human rights to have access to culture. Mm. Because it's very interesting. Because, for instance, from my perspective, the people who are controlling the conversation, they talk about cheaters, pirates, free riders, but they don't talk about the sacred human rights to have access to your own culture. And since we live in a global society, we're talking about a global culture. And for instance, I come from Brazil, a country where the people who are controlling the conversation like to identify like the country of pirates, free riders, like Brazil, China, India, Russia. And what happens is that those countries, most people, they are very poor and they cannot really buy culture. They cannot afford to buy culture. And I think that perhaps we should also debate how those people who cannot really afford culture, they can exercise their human rights to have access to their own culture. And so I'm very concerned about this trend that it's very strong here in the U.S. about commodification of culture, of cultural goods. So we are kind of creating a cultural apartheid where if you can afford it, you can have it. And if you cannot afford culture, you are bound to be just looking. So if you are in the haves, you can really enjoy it.
Yeah,
if you are a have-not, you
can enjoy it. This problem manifests itself in a lot of different ways. Like, for example, here in the U.S., librarians are going nuts about, you know, the various proprietary technologies for digitizing books. You know, so books, to the extent that they're a part of your, you know, a country's culture or art or anything like that, you know, there are a lot of commercial interests to make sure that their proprietary technologies are the ones that end up being the way this stuff is encoded digitally in perpetuity, but assuring the legacy of the company who owns the technology that does that. And what that does is you end up in this exact same situation where the haves and the have-nots, people who have access to the right technology to crack 50-year-old formats that aren't in use anymore, are the ones who get to see that culture, and the ones who don't. So, and that's probably closest to you.
Well, I think the law needs to reconceptualize how creativity occurs and how value is created, because intellectual property law presumes that the only thing that's valuable that's created involves the transfer of money and property rights, where we know intuitively, if not especially through the internet, that all sorts of valuable things occur through natural human sharing and communities, but the law doesn't recognize or validate that sufficiently. So that's part of, I think, our legal challenge of devising new legal vehicles to recognize that genuinely valuable culture and creativity occurs without or with only minimal aspects of the market involved.
We're out of time. I just want to ask one more question. Is like, internationally, does anybody have any clue? I mean, we're pretty progressive. We're sitting here at the Center of Thought Leadership in Cambridge, Massachusetts, discussing some fairly thorny issues. Are these discussions even taking place? I mean, in some ways, that puts us ahead of the game a little bit, but I would venture to guess that there are plenty of places around the world where this discussion isn't even taking place.
Actually, if I could put an addendum, on Friday through this weekend in Rio de Janeiro, the Creative Commons is having an international summit of several dozen countries, and so it actually is a rather robust conversation.
I wanted to make a comment. My name is Leticia Pagan. I come from Puerto Rico. I teach MIS courses in a school of management here, and I have been taught in Massachusetts too. And we have a problem in terms of countries on how they see copyrights, because some countries see copying as collaboration and others as competition. So we need to think about that, because when you have international students here, you have the problem of, the students are experts from school like this one, because they copy, but in their culture, they have to collaborate with the ones who come from the same place. And this is something that has to be taken into consideration when we are talking about internet and this piece that we talk about, intellectual property. And because we don't have laws that cover every country in the world, besides we can see the ONU, but this is besides, it's very difficult to think about having this global conversation that she just mentioned, and about culture as culture per se, because we are in a business world and we are talking about things and we are talking about money, yeah, and they change prices. So it's very complicated. We cannot talk about all these things together. We just have to put things aside and then talk about copyrights in the perspective of this world where we live. But in other words, it's different. And it needs to take a lot of time to everybody understand that. It's not only about money, also it's about social economics too. So it's very complicated when you go and look at the semantic web and you try to find your name. You put your name there and there are a lot of people with your name and a lot of things that does not belong to you. And then you have a Google site with your name with 30 hits and only 3 are reliable and accurate. So it's an issue also about reliability and accuracy. So we have a lot of things to do in terms of what we find in this environment.
Yeah. David, just one quick thought, just to say, kind of where I'm at. But tomorrow is an open space. It's the third day. Because the issues you're raising are so important, and they're not going to be adequately addressed today alone. And I encourage you, I hope you're planning to stay. In other words, you can convene sessions tomorrow to address these issues. And that's, as we start to hear what people are really thinking, these are profoundly important topics. And I just the fact that you came from Puerto Rico and from Brazil to be here for this, that's the best forum we're going to have is tomorrow to be able to convene others who are here and share these interests.
So just so in case anybody doesn't know what open space is, it's a methodology for holding discussions. And instead of this sort of a format where there's a bunch of people in front, the two of you get together and say, we're going to hold a discussion on culture and copyright or something like that. And then you go, you write it down, we're going to hold this discussion on culture and copyright at 9 o'clock in this room, and anybody who's interested in that goes to that room, and you have a great discussion. And maybe you meet people and you organize something and you actually get something done. So that's what the open space methodology is. I think what she just said is a real example of how, you know, when you think about this sort of the issues connected to identity, there's literally no issue that's not connected to identity, I mean, in our world. So I don't think we can close on a more on a better note. So I'd like to thank all of our panelists for coming and sharing their wisdom with us. It was really terrific to have all these different perspectives. It added a lot of value to the session. Thank you very much, guys.